From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And for the rest of the program today, we're going to be talking about a difficult and potentially divisive subject. Earlier this month, legislation was filed in the Illinois Senate that would allow people with a terminal diagnosis to seek medical help in ending their lives. There are 10 other states, plus the District of Columbia, that already have such laws. Advocates say it allows people to die on their own terms, sparing themselves and their families from needless, prolonged suffering. And on the other side, critics of these laws say there are too many risks with making such a decision with no takebacks. What if the diagnosis is wrong? And how can you really be sure someone wasn't coerced into this decision? Joining us now to talk more about this is the sponsor of the legislation in Illinois. State Senator Linda Holmes is a Democrat from Aurora. Her district includes that city as well as parts of Batavia, Naperville, and Oswego. Senator Holmes, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be able to have this discussion.
Also with us, Kadeen Bennett, Director of Advocacy and Intergovernmental Affairs for the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. Kadeen, welcome back to the 21st Show to you as well.
Thank you. It's good to hear your voice again.
Also with us is Amber Smock, Vice President of Advocacy for Access Living, a civil rights group for people with disabilities. Amber, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here with all of you today.
Listeners, you can join our conversation today at 800-222-9455. What do you think of this idea? Have you watched a relative suffer with cancer or some other terminal disease and had them tell you they would have rather ended their life? Or is this a bridge too far? 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. Senator Holmes, I want to begin with you. Where did the idea for you to file this legislation, where did that come from?
To be honest, I was elected in 2006. Prior to even being elected, this was a subject I was somewhat passionate about due to having seen my father die of cancer when I was 15. So to have the opportunity to do this in the Illinois Senate was sort of, I call this would be a legacy piece of legislation for me. And through those years, many, many years, obviously, since I've been elected, I have seen people becoming more and more open to this. And I say that's because so many of us baby boomers have seen our parents die. In my case, it's two parents dying of cancer. So I think right now this doesn't break out by race or religion or anything because so many people have a lived experience. And I think that's why the approval has gone up into, 71% of people surveyed are saying they're in favor of this.
Well, let's talk about the language of the proposal itself. If people want to look this up, it's Senate Bill 3499. We'll have a link to it on our website, 21stshow.org. How would this work?
Well, this quite simply, you have several qualifications you have to meet. You have to be an adult 18 years or older. You have to be diagnosed by a physician of having your diagnosis is giving you 6 months or less to live. That has to be backed up by another physician who has to agree with that. If either of those physicians has any concerns about your mental capabilities, then you have to also be examined by a mental health professional. These are a lot of the guardrails that are built into this. So nobody can choose to do this simply because they have a disability or they're just getting old. You have to be mentally capable of making this decision. We call this informed consent. You have to know all the other options. The doctor's obligated to tell you what your other options are, whether it's hospice, palliative care, pain management. They have to tell you what all those options are so that you can make this decision. The patient has to request it of the doctor.
And there has to be witnesses, right? And it can't be somebody who's in the will, so to speak, just to get that out there.
Yes. And I want to do that because I want to tell you there's over 20 what I call guardrails in place to make sure that this cannot be abused. This has been in Oregon since 1997. And during that time, there has not been one case of abuse of this or misuse of this. And I guess my biggest point is always going to be, I'm deeply offended when somebody calls this suicide. And I will tell you, when losing my father at the age of 15, my father did not want to die. He would have loved to have seen his kids grow up and graduate school, see his daughter become a senator. My mother died in 2016, so she had the opportunity to see those things, but she didn't have the opportunity to see her son, her grandson graduate from high school or be accepted into one of the top 20 law schools in the country. I mean, these people do not want to die. They don't have a choice. They're going to die.
And I think, Brian, just in terms of your question, in terms of the process, I think, you know, the patient learns of their prognosis that they have 6 months or less to live. The patient meets the criteria of being 18, that they have the mental capacity to make this decision. And they make an oral request to their attending physician. That oral request has to be followed by a written request. And that written request includes, as you mentioned, a witness requirement. There are two witnesses that are required, but one of those witnesses cannot be a relative, or they can't be somebody entitled to any part of the estate or a will. They can't be an owner or operator of a healthcare entity where the patient is getting care. The attending physician can't be a witness. If somebody requires an interpreter, those people can't be a witness. So that's a guardrail that exists there. And then there has to be a period of 5 days between the first oral request, and then there will need to be a second oral request after the written request. At each opportunity or each moment, the physician has to let the patient know that they could rescind their request at any time. And as Senator Holmes says, if at any time, either with the attending physician, the consulting physician, the process of the oral and written requests, the doctor believes that there is like any kind of issue with mental health that may preclude the person from having access to that treatment, the physician can at any time say, we need to have you go see a mental health care provider. And it's only after the two oral requests and the written requests can the person become eligible to get their prescription. And again, they are told again of all of their options, and also that they never need to take the medication, that they have the ability at any time to essentially rescind their request and choose not to go forward with taking the prescription.
All right. Thank you for laying all that out there, Kadine Bennett with the ACLU of Illinois. I want to go now to Amber Smock with Access Living. What are some of your concerns with this legislation?
Sure. So what I'd like to say, first of all, is that Access Living and disability advocates have been tracking this issue since the 1980s. And given the last 30, 40 years of discussion about people with disabilities and what I know the proponents call aid in dying, and I'm afraid I am going to offend Senator Holmes, but we do call it assisted suicide in the Land of Disability Rights book. And so this is something that we've been talking about for decades. It has been the subject of three separate federal reports by the National Council on Disability, which is the federal agency that advises the White House and Congress on disability rights issues. And each time that federal agency has come out in opposition to assisted suicide, because there are too many ways where what is posed as an option, a choice for just one person, actually has significant ramifications for many other people. So I want to speak a little bit to we were talking about hearing that there are a lot of guardrails, there are a lot of protections, et cetera, et cetera. And I want to say that what Access Living's concern is that these are not enough. And there won't be enough. And that there are multiple reasons for why that would happen. One is that, first of all, it's not true to say that there's no evidence of coercion, including in the state of Oregon. I want to point to the story of Michael Freeland, who was a 43-year-old Black man with a documented history of mental health issues. And he asked about assisted suicide in Oregon, and he was not given a mental health examination. He was provided with lethal drugs and so forth. So even though there's this assumption that people with disabilities will be protected and screened out from this process where it puts them at risk, that's actually not true. A different way that coercion can happen is also through the insurance industry. And this bill fails to address problems with the insurance industry. Insurance industry want to see people, they don't necessarily want to spend a huge amount of money on providing people with appropriate supports or expensive drugs, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a lot cheaper to give people legal medication. And in the case of a woman named Barbara Wagner in Oregon, she was talking to her insurance company about her health situation, her terminal stuff. And rather than being offered life-affirming treatment that she knew was out there, the insurance company instead offered her the option of using aid and die and lethal medication. And if that's not something that you're looking for, it can be incredibly offensive. It can be incredibly damaging at a very vulnerable point in your life. So when people say there is no evidence that coercion doesn't exist, that's not true. So going back to guardrails, though, one of the things that is a problem with existing laws is that they provide very little accountability for investigating instances of abuse. Physicians have immunity, and the information about what happens with patients is basically sealed. And so you can't really go in there and investigate and find out what's really going on. These laws are built that way because proponents will say this is about privacy. We want doctors to not fear recrimination. But the reality is we don't know what's going on in those situations, and it's very difficult to find out. And so the accountability of public transparency is very minimal with something like this. I also just want to point out.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let me give some of our other guests an opportunity to you've raised a number of interesting points there.
Okay, sure.
And Senator Holmes, I don't know, I think I'll just pick one of them and you can take it where you will. But, you know, certainly the idea that insurance companies don't always have their customers' best interest at heart, I think, is going to resonate with a lot of people. I don't know if you want to respond to that or something else we heard there.
I don't know where we get that the insurance company is going to be the one talking to the patient to tell them they should choose this. This just isn't the way this works. It's got to be the patient that makes an oral request to the doctor. And I have to say, we have to quit saying that the disability community as a whole is opposed to this. I have worked closely, being that I was diagnosed when I was, so this is 35 years ago, with MS. So I have worked very, very closely with individuals with MS. And studies, we will have dueling studies here because Impact Research did a study with 700 respondents. Those that said that they had a disability were still, 73% of them were supporting this. I want to say, just because you have a disability does not give you the option to talk to your doctor about this. Plain and simple, you have to have a diagnosis of having 6 months or less to live. In most cases, it's going to be something like ALS or cancer. It is not going to be something like MS. So we just can't simply say the disability community is uniformly opposed to this or is going to be abused because of this.
And Brian, to your question about insurance and with Amber's concern, and just to be clear, we have worked with Access Living for quite a long time, have a lot of respect for them as an organization. And I think the thing that we have in common is the belief of bodily autonomy for all people. And I think that's what brings the ACLU to this issue. And wanting to have guardrails in place as much as we can, we're always open to more suggestions for language or things that we can do. But as it relates to insurance, there is a provision that says it's unlawful for an insurer to deny or alter healthcare benefits that would be otherwise available to a patient with a terminal disease based on the availability of aid in dying care, or to try to coerce a patient with a terminal disease to make a request for aid in dying medication. So that is something that is important. It's in the language. And again, happy to add more of those kinds of protective language in place.
Well, and what about that idea that this is difficult to investigate because of the privacy protections around medical care, for example, the HIPAA law?
Yeah, I mean, there is also language around the immunity is not a blanket immunity. It's if you're acting in good faith with the requirements under this law. So again, this is similar to other kinds of care that exist where you have to act in good faith. If you don't, then that would trigger an investigation.
We need to take a break in a couple of minutes here. I've got to say, we've got some calls coming in. I want to ask our callers to stay on the line. We'll get to you right after the break. But Senator Holmes, what about the physician side of this? I know there are certainly a lot of doctors out there who think this goes against their role as a healer. Obviously, there will be some others who are willing to participate. What if a doctor is not comfortable with this sort of act? Will they sort of be able to opt out of it? I mean, do they have to refer someone to someone who will help would help a patient with this, as is the case with abortion in Illinois?
Well, the doctor is not compelled to do this. If they don't wish to, ideally they would be able to refer the patient, but the patient themselves can just see another doctor who is not opposed to this. So the doctor is not obligated and cannot be sued or held responsible. He's got his he or she has their total freedom in not doing this if it is against their beliefs.
Yeah, and just to add to that, Brian, right now, as you may know, we have the Healthcare Right of Conscience Act in Illinois that allows for conscience objections to providing different kinds of medical care. That language, that legislation, or that law is referenced in this law as well. That would essentially say anyone can opt out. There, we even have language that says there's no duty to provide medical aid in dying, both for healthcare professionals and entities. The only thing that we require, and this is also under the Healthcare Right of Conscience Act, is if you are not going to provide the care, transferring the patient's records in a timely way, and if possible, sharing a where the patient could go to get help. That's not an official referral. That is a structure that healthcare professionals have to abide by right now under the Healthcare Right of Conscience Act.
All right, we are going to take a break. We will continue this conversation on a proposal in the Illinois General Assembly that would allow people with a terminal illness, a terminal diagnosis, to seek medical help in ending their lives. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about a proposal in the Illinois General Assembly that would allow patients with a terminal illness, a 6-month diagnosis, to have the option to end their life with the help of a physician. And we're talking about this with the legislation sponsor, State Senator Linda Holmes, a Democrat from Aurora, Kadeen Bennett with the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois, which supports this proposal, and Amber Smock with Access Living, which is a civil rights group that advocates for people with disabilities. You can join us at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And let's go now to line four, where Joe is calling from Urbana. Joe, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, good morning. I'm calling because I think a lot of times we have a tendency to become hyperbolic about it. I mean, fear. I mean, anybody, I mean, I think. I mean, I'm a mental health worker. I've lost a brother through depression, and he chose to end his life. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about someone who's terminal. And being terminal means that you know what the outcome is. And I mean, the outcome of all life is death, but you'd rather not see your children watch you die. My children know that if I were ever to be diagnosed with a terminal illness, that it is okay. And they will be okay with me saying, "Hey, Dad's ready to go. Let him go. Let him say, do whatever he needs to do." Because it's not about I'm living a life and I'm living a good life. And when it's time to go, and if I am terminal, yes. And there is no, I mean, like some like pancreatic cancer, there is no way it's going to get better. Then let me go. My mom right now is in hospice, and it's a heart condition, and it's a slow. One day I know I'll wake up and she wouldn't wake up because that's what a heart condition with on in hospice is. And it's just what it is, and we've got to stop being so fearful about this whole thing called death.
Joe, thank you. Joe, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your perspective on that. I appreciate it.
Can I comment on that?
Please, Senator, go ahead.
Because I want to thank Joe, because that quite simply is what we're finding the more and more people I talk to. My mother, diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, she had raised us probably because she watched her husband die of lung cancer almost 50 years ago. I was 15, extremely painful, a vibrant, healthy man, emaciated in a hospital bed, vomiting the last day I saw him. That's my final memory of seeing my father alive. So I believe when my mother got pancreatic cancer, we were raised knowing that we would do nothing. There was no, if she was going to die, let her die. Don't do anything. And fortunately, she had that in place. I had her power of attorney on her medical issues, so that when she ended up going into hospice with her pancreatic cancer and getting a horrible infection, which ultimately killed her, they asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, do nothing, just keep her comfortable. And that's exactly what we did. I just applaud Joe for saying, this is what people themselves want. No one wants to suffer like that. And as a daughter watching a parent die, it is a horrible thing to lose a parent. We all know how devastating it is when one of our parents dies, but nothing is more difficult than watching somebody you love suffer. That is way worse than losing them.
So this is Amber. So
yeah, please,
like other people, I also lost a parent to cancer. My father died of colon cancer. And so I think what happens in this debate is that there are a lot of terrible stories. That's true. But there's also a fact, which is that introducing aid in dying / assisted suicide to Illinois is not just about you. It's going to create problems for other people. And that is the thing that we have to think about here, is that one person's ability to choose this particular option is actually going to create problems for many other people. This is, in fact, a society where people with disabilities, people who are dying, people with substance abuse issues are treated as disposable. And we do not have a social inclination or the social capacity to really make sure that this is an individual choice. It's not an individual choice. It's something that affects a lot of other people. And that's what it comes down to. And so you have to make a decision about whether your individual choice is worth creating problems for others. That's what it comes down to for us.
Amber, is there any set of safeguards that you think would sufficiently address some of your concerns? Because I know on Access Living's website, for example, you talk about the idea that there are existing things like people can have a do not resuscitate order in place, right? They can refuse care. But I think what we've heard from some of the other guests today is that that's not enough. They want to have this additional option. So is there any level of safeguards you could imagine that would make this something where you would at least say, well, I'm going to be neutral on it, if not supportive of it?
Yes, the fact of the matter is people do have the right to refuse treatment, do not resuscitate orders. They can designate living well, physician orders for life-sustaining treatment. There are a lot of options that exist in Illinois to control how you do the end of life. The fact of the matter is, though, that an end of life, physician-assisted medication, lethal medication option is just dangerous for people with disabilities. That's just a fact. And I would like to point something out too. People will say that this kind of option is the humane thing to do. But the country that is the foremost in thinking about and progressing on assisted suicide / aid in dying is the Netherlands. And in the Netherlands, the conversation there is that it's not just humane to allow people to access medication. What you need to do is also make sure the doctor is ready to step in if the person's not dying the way they're supposed to. So all of the legislation, all of the existing options, once you introduce it, you start changing it. And in California, there's already a proposal to reduce a 2-week waiting period for this to 48 hours. And so once you start this, there is no ending how this is going to be amended and how this is going to open up. So I would say that no safeguards are going to be enough, just no option.
But that's not true, because the bill would have to be followed as the bill is written in order for it to impact anyone in any different way, or any of these other things you talk about are happening in other places or other countries. Could not happen here with this bill, because this bill will pass as written. Should somebody propose changes to this bill at a later date, we don't control that.
And maybe true, but it won't be true in the future. It will not be true in the future. And again, as I said, people with disabilities ought have to deal a lot with insurance. We have to constantly deal with what insurance will and will not pay for. We are constantly denied life-saving medical treatment that would help us. And when we are put in that position and then someone says, well, why don't you just end it all, take this medication? People are very vulnerable to that. And so the insurance industry is absolutely not going to pay attention to this bill. That's just how it's going to work in practice.
So Senator Holmes, I hear you're saying let's focus on the legislation as it's written before us. And I hear Amber Smock saying, we look at what's happened in other states and other countries. And yes, there are revisions to every piece of legislation or every law that goes into place over time. Talk about how you thought about what other states have done. Were there lessons that you took in this, Senator Holmes, in things that maybe you thought were not done as well as they should have been in other states or other countries?
Well, and I would probably let Kadeen address more of that because
sure.
I wasn't part of all those other states seeing how this was done. But yes, we did look at what other states are doing. And yes, we do have different provisions. And I think we just have probably, we've got over 20 what I call guardrails in this to try to prevent any abuses or it being misused. I just still have such a problem with saying that a person should not have the ability to decide they don't want to suffer. And understand that of these patients, 88% are already in hospice, right? So they're already in hospice care. So there is palliative care being done. But sometimes that just isn't enough. And the suffering is unbearable. Also, 33% of the people that get this prescription decide not to use it. So it's a great palliative comfort to know that, wait, if my suffering does become unbearable, I have the option to do this. Doesn't necessarily mean I have to do it though. So I guess I keep saying, if you're opposed to it, that's fine. Don't do it. But why take it away from those of us? And if the last survey is done, it's 71% of us. Why take that option away from us?
And I suppose you could argue that people do have a legal right to seek to end their own lives in.
Brian, I'm sorry.
Let me finish with Senator Holmes, if I may. I mean, what I hear from you, I think, is people can also seek to end their lives in with a different means that's not medical, right? I mean, we don't have to list them here, but
right.
This in your view, is adding another option to that, a more palatable or compassionate option. I don't know. You say it how you want it, how you will.
Well, less stressful for the family. And if somebody does actually go and commit suicide, they could then impact a lot of different things because your death certificate when you die, if you commit suicide, is going to list you committing suicide. In this case, say it would have been my mother, say she had been able to choose this option. Her death certificate would say she died of pancreatic cancer. I mean, technically she died of an infection because of the pancreatic cancer. But no, she died of pancreatic cancer. And that would say that. So that would then leave, it wouldn't negate what's in her will or let her heirs be able to collect that because it's not suicide. So there is real reasons for wanting to do this in this manner.
Amber Smock, you were trying to get in there and I rudely interrupted you. Go ahead, please.
I appreciate that. Thank you. So what I want to just say about this is that the ability to prescribe lethal medication to people is just another tool to deny care to people who are dependent on others. And I want to say that, like speaking to what Senator Holmes said, in terms of people having their condition list and their death certificate, there are cases out there where people who are dying are hurried along by providers. There are situations where the family will say, please make sure my loved one has fluid, please make sure that they have medication. And the doctors and nurses, whether intentionally or through negligence, they don't do it. And so that is another way to end someone's life, even if they're already dying. What gets listed on the death certificate is not that they were killed by the healthcare providers, but what they were in the hospital there for in the first place, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, what have you. So there is a lot of under the radar stuff that happens. And I also just want to say this too, is that people say that, Oh, well, there's a lot of responsibility here. There's going to be, physician immunity, et cetera. The bar for physicians in the case of end of life options like this is simply that you make a good faith decision that is lower than the standard of medical negligence that exists for malpractice cases. It's lower. So there are a lot of problems with this situation. And what I would just hope is that people understand that this choice creates problems for other people. You want your choice, you need to assess that it's going to harm a lot of other people.
If I
I
could jump
think.
in, Brian, I think not having this choice is harmful to folks as well. And I do think that I hear Amber's concern around people who feel like they're a burden to family members. I think right now there are people who may feel that way, so they refuse any kind of care so that they could quicken their death so that their family members don't face that kind of burden or so that exists right now with or without this law. We also know that doctors are able. Are in a place where they're able to assess whether or not someone is being coerced into this care. The person has to decide for themselves. A family member can't decide for them. A healthcare proxy can't decide for them. The person has to make that request themselves, and they have to make that request three times. And just to talk a little bit about why in Illinois, I mean, there, as you mentioned, there are 10 states in the District of Columbia where people are able to go. But in my years of working on this issue, and probably since 2012, I've been working and talking to folks about looking at the opportunity to get this law in Illinois. And these are people who've had their own terminal illnesses, who've passed away in the interim, who've had loved ones who they've seen in really difficult conditions. And I think of one person, his name is Andrew. His mom, Susie, is Andrew's from Illinois. His mom, Susie, is from Illinois, a school teacher. Andrew was a teacher as well. And I chatted with him probably 2 summers ago, and he really wanted to advocate for this. He was somebody who was diagnosed as terminal. He was living in California. And one of the things he said is, I really wish that I could, when it's time for me to end my life, have the ability to take the medication in Illinois with my family members. He talked about the privilege he had about being able to have family members who can come to California, but really wanted to be home. And I think for a lot of people, this is what they want. They want the ability to, they are terminal, to make the decision to access this prescription and to end it within on their terms. And I think that we could all agree we would never want a law that would exempt terminal folks who are living with disabilities. We know that there are people who feel like this is the right choice for them, whether or not there's a terminal person living with disabilities
And
or not.
I'm sorry, I'm afraid we are out of time, and we are going to have to end the conversation there. Kadeen Bennett, Amber Smock, and State Senator Linda Holmes, it's been a very thorough discussion. Thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st show. And that is it. We will be back again tomorrow.